Hi, folks, and welcome to the Empowering Dietitians podcast, where each week I explore a different topic to help you feel more confident and connected to your work as a dietitian. I'm your host, Jess Serdikoff-Ramola, a registered dietitian, dietitian supervisor, and owner of Empowering Dietitians, where I help burnt out and unhappy dietitians opt out of hustle culture and reclaim their passion and purpose as a human first and dietitian second. After all, we are all more than a dietitian. This episode of the Empowering Dietitians podcast is specific to my US-based dietitians or any dietitian or student considering practicing in the United States. State licensure has been a hot topic in the field and a source of much frustration and confusion, which I've touched on before. But what about the recent proposal for an interstate licensure compact? What does the draft proposal say? How will this affect our work as dietitians? And will this actually make interstate and telehealth practice more accessible and affordable? I've read all the policy documents, attended the informational sessions, and communicated with representatives for the proposal to bring you as much clarification and information as possible, in hopefully a much more digestible way. Currently, interstate practice in the United States is messy at best. There is a constant stream of Facebook posts from confused dietitians about whether or not they can practice in a specific state, and opinions on this abound. I highly encourage you to take a look at episode 89 of the podcast, Practicing Across State Lines, What's Actually Legal, for a more in-depth discussion of our current legal constraints, as I found there to be a lot of misinformation in Facebook groups on this subject. But there's an important update to add to the mix, and if you're a dietitian in the U.S. or someone who sees clients who reside in the U.S., this is something you want to know about. The Academy and CDR are pushing for a licensure compact, which would basically be an agreement amongst multiple U.S. states to allow for more fluid interstate practice of dietitians. This compact is still in draft form, but it is moving forward in the legislative process. In this episode, we are going to cover what is a licensure compact, what are some potential roadblocks, the biggest criticisms that I hear for the compact, and lastly, where we are in the process and what you can expect moving forward. So first, what is a licensure compact? In this case, it is an agreement amongst a minimum of seven states, so it will not go into effect until at least seven states opt in to participate. More on that in a little bit and throughout the episode overall. Basically, how it works is you would pay for a licensure in your home state. This home state has to be the state in which you reside, and it has to be opted in to participate in the compact. You comply with all rules and regulations for that home state's licensure, all of the fees, the continuing ed, everything. And you have to maintain that license to be eligible for participation in compacts associated with it. Once you are licensed in your home state and your home state has opted into the compact, you can optionally apply for a compact to practice with other participating states. This will involve additional fees, which will be determined later on in the legislative process. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be state by state, but it might be specific to the compact, like all states within the compact have the same fee. But it is generally much less expensive than a full-on second license, which is what you would have to do now. This compact version of a license will also have to be renewed periodically, again, at a frequency that will be determined later in the legislative process. But from what I've been hearing, it will likely follow similar rules to the actual licensure, which is generally every 2 years. And again, it will include that fee every X number of years, but at the reduced rate. You would not need to submit additional paperwork to them to maintain the license once that application has gone through. So that means you do not need to juggle continuing ed and like prove that you're keeping up with continuing ed for multiple different states. So to clarify, if my home state of New Jersey, which is admittedly a pretty bad example because our licensure hasn't taken effect yet, but it's going to before this compact does. So let's say for the purposes of this example, it has taken effect. If my home state of New Jersey is in a compact with, say, Pennsylvania, Florida, Massachusetts, Texas, North Carolina, and Ohio, I would need to apply to each of those other states individually if I want to be able to practice in all seven of them. So I'd still have to submit seven different applications, but only the New Jersey one would be as extensive as a standard license. The idea is that the application for the compact states, those six other states, Pennsylvania, Florida, Massachusetts, etc., for me in this situation, the states where you do not reside, will be more streamlined, less involved, and less expensive. You do not have to participate in the compact. You can still apply for individual state licenses. So even if I live in New Jersey and New Jersey is in a compact agreement with Pennsylvania, if for whatever reason I decide I don't want to go the compact route, I want a full-on Pennsylvania license, I can still apply for it and pay all the fees and keep track of the continuing ed and do the same process that I currently have at my disposal, right? It's just going to be a little bit more expensive and clunkier of a process. The idea is, of course, for as many states as possible to opt into this compact. Would it still add up financially if we have to pay for, say, like one home state plus 49 other states if they all participated and you wanted the freedom to take clients like literally wherever they lived in the country? Yeah, it probably would. But it would be less, at least in theory at this point, than individually applying for full-on licenses in all 50 states. Now, this policy does come with some roadblocks. You might have already thought of some yourself. After all, not all 50 states even have licensure laws, which is the first major roadblock. Your home state must have licensure or certification to be part of a compact. You cannot join a compact from a non-participating state. Apparently, the only states currently ineligible for participation are California, Colorado, Virginia, Michigan, and Arizona. So, if you live in any of those states, you would first need to advocate for them to adopt state licensure. Then you would have to advocate for them opting into the compact, and then you could participate. If you live in any of these states currently, the only way that you could practice in other states would be through the current system of applying for a full out-of-state license. Now, states that do not have licensure but do have title protection or certification, like New York, for example, would be eligible according to the draft policy. But again, they do still have to choose to participate in the compact, which is the second roadblock. Not all states tend to pass compact legislation, historically. In fact, California and New York have literally never passed compact legislation, aka they have literally never agreed to participate in license compacts for any other profession, which does not bode well for dietitians residing in New York or California, or for dietitians who live in bordering states like New Jersey, who would want a more affordable, accessible way to see patients across state lines. It also presents a bit of a roadblock in the implementation phase itself. We have to wait for statewide legislation to be passed before we can participate in any of this. One more roadblock. I don't know if it's a roadblock per se, and for all I know, because I only hold one state license and I haven't extensively read every sentence of the vast majority of state licenses and state licensure laws. So maybe this is standard inclusion for those already. But in the draft compact, there is a clause that states, in quotes, "A member state, if otherwise permitted by state law, may recover from the affected licensee the costs of investigations and dispositions of cases resulting from any adverse action taken against the licensee." End quote. Which, okay, I'm not a lawyer. I could be interpreting this totally incorrectly, but it kind of sounds to me like if you get reported or a state licensing board starts up an investigation into your practice regarding your professional conduct, a state may actually make you pay their legal and investigative fees, which, if not a roadblock, is certainly a red flag, maybe, in my book. Plus, any other state in the compact will get notified of any pending investigation on your end, and then they'll be allowed to consider their own investigation and take adverse action against you, too. Now, I don't want to fear monger here or like be alarmist. It's not like these investigations happen a lot. It is actually pretty difficult to have investigations opened, or at least it's not super common. But it is fine print that I personally would want to be aware of, so I wanted to mention it on here. And certainly, if this does take effect, you might want to present the language to a lawyer for review so that you fully understand what you're signing up for. Again, because I could be completely off base with my interpretation. Okay, so there are definitely some roadblocks. You even may be thinking, like, ugh, this is such a hassle. I'm just going to call my services coaching instead of M&T and not bother with any of it. Again, please listen to episode 89 for more on that sentiment specifically. But another really important thing to note is that these licensure laws and regulations apply when either you or the patient or client is located in the state in question. So, for example, if I live in New Jersey and I want to see someone in Pennsylvania, I have to know not only what is legal, acceptable ways of practicing in Pennsylvania, but also what is considered legal and acceptable in New Jersey. We often say that it's based on where the client or patient is located, which is absolutely true. But we don't get to totally disregard the laws and regulations of the state in which we reside. We have to pay attention to both. And maybe that adds to your frustration. And you're finding yourself wondering the big question, the biggest criticism by far of the whole issue of state licensure. Why do we need state licenses at all? Why can't simply being a registered dietitian on a national level be enough? I'll tell you the answer that the reps gave me when I asked this, and then I'm also going to tell you some other political reasons for it. I mean, all of the reasons are political, but a more like foundational reason regarding how the US government functions. So the first answer I got when I pushed back on this was essentially that states, quote unquote, need your money, and some smaller, more remote states, quote unquote, rely on licensure fees. Interestingly, if you read the draft compact section, 8G3, you really want to read it. It basically says that the compact fees that individual dietitians need to pay are supposed to be set so that they cover the cost of the commission's salary and operating expenses, which kind of implies that the only reason we have to pay is to uphold the bureaucracy of regulating this. But again, maybe as a non-lawyer, I'm misinterpreting that. Another reason, which is super legitimate, is that states want to be able to know who is practicing within their jurisdiction. It's an accountability and liability concern. Licensure and compact applications are ways to keep track of which practitioners are practicing in any given state, at least which ones are supposed to be. Of course, this explanation or reason doesn't really explain why you can't just have a registration list, you know, why you have to pay. And of course, it doesn't really address the major flaw in that there isn't really much stopping me from not informing a state that I plan to practice there and kind of flying under the radar until or unless I get caught. Not that I'm advocating for that, but it's keeping track of the rule followers, but not necessarily the people who are breaking the rules. So I don't know. There's some questionable effectiveness there with that theory. But lastly, we have to remember about how the U.S. was set up. If you think way back to like high school U.S. history or government class, there was a big push from the beginning away from one overarching power authority. That's why we're supposed to have checks and balances to the different branches of government, and that's why so much of our laws are deferred to states' rights. Whether you believe in a big centralized government or you prefer that states hold most of the power, the reality in the U.S. is that very little is determined on a like national federal level. Most issues are handled state to state. So in my opinion, and this doesn't come from any reps of this policy specifically, a big reason we are forced to go through state licensure instead of just being able to practice if we hold the RD credential is because we live in a country that values states' rights over sweeping national legislation in most cases. So in summary, if you're frustrated that you jumped through all of these hoops to get credentialed as an RD, and yet you still have all of this bureaucratic BS to deal with from one state to another, I hear you. I get it. It is super frustrating. It all boils down to a combination of states' rights and also capitalism. Gotta love it. Also, regardless of whether you think this is right or good or whatever, this is literally how every other profession practices, basically, especially in the healthcare field. The argument of, well, everyone else does it, so I guess we should too, is a pretty lame one, in my opinion, but it is the reality of our world and society. So it's going to be much harder to break from the default way of operating, especially when government is concerned. If it's a hill you want to die on, I would suggest getting more involved in nutrition legislation, policy, and government. And genuinely, I mean this with no sarcasm whatsoever. Best of luck to you. One more kind of related criticism that I didn't put in my notes originally, but is worth mentioning. One frustrating part of licensure overall is that it seems to heavily regulate and restrict the practice of credentialed, highly qualified, highly trained individuals without really doing much to protect the public against unqualified, like grifters and misinformed, untrained service providers. This is true of our current policy for state licensure, and I would imagine it will be no different if a compact takes effect, and it's a valid criticism. Because while in theory the laws prohibit non-qualified individuals from practicing nutrition care, in actual reality and practice, it's next to impossible to prosecute or really do anything about someone who is practicing unethically if they aren't a member of a professional body. It is much easier to go after a registered dietitian who is simply practicing in the quote-unquote wrong state than it is to go after some random personal trainer or the lady down the street for giving problematic and harmful nutrition advice. It's a valid criticism. It's one I know a lot of you have, but I don't personally see the compact making this particular issue either better or worse. Kind of just a separate issue to address. So for better or worse, this compact legislation is moving forward. And unfortunately, in the time it took me to simply get answers to my questions about the draft policy and then get this podcast episode up, the comment period has closed. So where are we at currently? The compact policy is in draft mode. I will include links to read it in its entirety if you like, assuming access to the document remains publicly available. There may also be representatives you can contact listed in those resources if you want to submit some additional feedback. They're not publicly taking opinions, but it doesn't hurt, again, to send them an email with your thoughts upon reading the draft if you're able to. They anticipate the compact to be ready for introduction during the 2024 legislative sessions, which is basically getting it onto the floor, right? From there, we have to wait for the first seven states to join, assuming that it goes through the full legislative process on the floor. And from that point, that at least seven states have opted into it, it usually takes another 18 months to form the commission and to work on activating the compact for licensees. Remember, the participating states have to agree on actual compact rules and fees. The commission has to be formed. There are a lot of steps to go through still. My original thought was that we were looking at a solid 2 years before we see this take effect. But after hearing from the reps about that like 18-month estimate on top of everything else, I wouldn't be surprised if we're closer to 3+ years out. I'm also not sure how next year being an election year may or may not impact legislation. I don't know how functional the Senate and House are going to wind up being, which policies actually make it to the floor, even if we anticipate that it's going to be introduced or we say that it's going to be introduced. All of that, again, good political stuff. In short, there is a lot still in flux with this policy, and there's a lot we still don't know beyond drafts and theories. I encourage you to stay updated on it to the best of your ability, and I certainly will be doing the same, and assuming I'm still podcasting in 3+ years, we'll likely have more information for you then. In the meantime, if you can get involved, or at least stay informed of what's going on at your state level, that's helpful. And there should be more resources rolling out over the next year or two, including a template letter that you can send to your representatives asking for their support in voting the compact through when it does get presented on the floor. All right. After all of this, what are your thoughts? What are your opinions and reactions to the idea of an interstate compact? I encourage you to let me know either by visiting the poll section of Spotify, which I will set up for this episode specifically, or reach out to me directly. I would love to hear your thoughts. Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Empowering Dietitians podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, there are two things you can do that dramatically help to support the show. First, leave a quick rating and/or review on your podcast listening app of choice. This helps new listeners find the show. Second, sharing this episode with a dietitian friend can also go a long way in spreading the anti-hustle message to dietitians far and wide. And speaking of supporting one another, please don't be a stranger if you find yourself in need of that supportive space yourself. There are a number of ways to work with me, from one-on-one supervision packages to my course, Abundance, and periodic live classes and workshops. The best way to stay up to date on which of these services and offerings are available at any given time? Grab my free dietitian journal to sign yourself up for my email list at www.empoweringdietitians.com/resources. That's www.empoweringdietitians.com/resources.